Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York has reopened a key funding program that could help Sullivan County finally move forward with a long-discussed homeless shelter and emergency housing project. But despite getting a second chance to apply, county officials say they're still not ready to submit a proposal. Why is it taking so long to reach an agreement, and what happens next? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports. A new documentary is shedding light on a little-known chapter in the history of the Catskill Game Farm, connecting the beloved tourist attraction to a German zoologist whose work was tied to Nazi-era breeding experiments. We'll talk with the Times Union reporter Sarah Tafton about the film American Zoo. Plus, the Deepwater Literary Festival founder Aaron Hicklin joins us with a preview of this year's fest, and culture reporter Valerie Manzi with the Juneteenth celebration after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he could resume bombing Iran if he doesn't like the tentative peace deal with Iran or Iran's behavior. NPR's Aya Batraoui says a little is known about the memo of understanding between the U.S. and Iran.
They say the first is ending the war. The second is that Iran would open the Strait of Hormuz again for commercial shipping. And the third is that the U.S. would end its blockade of Iranian ports. Iran also says that this is a one-and-a-half-page memorandum of understanding, and that after it is signed on Friday, the two sides will sit down for talks on the thorniest issues. That's Iran's nuclear program and U.S. sanctions.
NPR's Aya Batraoui reporting. President Trump has been talking about the tentative deal at the G7 summit in France that is now wrapping up. Trump is expected to hold a news conference soon. The G7 leaders praised the proposed deal but have called for an additional one to bring peace and stability to the Middle East. Stocks opened higher this morning as investors wait to hear from the new chair of the Federal Reserve this afternoon. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 200 points in early trading.
Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh is overseeing his first interest rate policy meeting this week. It comes as a wartime spike in energy prices has pushed inflation to its highest level in more than 3 years. The central bank is expected to hold its benchmark interest rate steady today. Retail sales rose more than expected last month, fueled in part by higher gasoline prices. Spending at gas stations rose 3.4% in May compared to April, while spending at grocery stores was flat and spending at restaurants was down. Gasoline prices have been inching lower in anticipation of a diplomatic deal to end the war with Iran, but AAA says the average price of regular gas is still about a buck a gallon higher than it was before the war started. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Lawyers for some 330,000 Haitians who are legally living in the U.S. have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to dismiss a major immigration case. They claim new evidence shows the Trump administration misrepresented key facts in the case. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Trump administration has repeatedly tried to deport Haitians who are living in the U.S. legally under temporary protected status. TPS was enacted by Congress in 1990 to protect people who cannot return to their home countries because their safety would be imperiled by war, civil unrest, or natural disasters. At the Supreme Court in April, the Trump administration sought once again to deport Haitians, many of whom have lived in the U.S. for decades. With a decision expected in the coming weeks, lawyers for the Haitians filed papers asking the High Court to dismiss the case because the Trump Justice Department, they said, misrepresented key facts that have surfaced in a separate case. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The National Hurricane Center says a tropical disturbance off Texas's Gulf Coast is too disorganized to be named a tropical storm. Forecasters warn up to 10 inches of rain could fall from Texas and Louisiana into Mississippi and Alabama. A passenger from the cruise ship with the cases of deadly hantavirus is still being held in a federal quarantine unit in Nebraska. NPR's Rob Stein reports the Department of Health and Human Services is defending its decision to continue holding her.
An HHS spokeswoman says Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is refusing to let Angela Perryman finish her 42-day quarantine at home because the state of Florida will not post a guard outside her home 24/7. Noting that the virus has a 40% fatality rate, HHS spokeswoman Courtney Spencer added that the decision is necessary to ensure both Perryman's and her community's well-being. Florida, most independent public health experts, and even an internal reviewer at the CDC, says a guard is unnecessary. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Yesterday's World Cup action proved to be thrilling. Argentina defeated Algeria 3-0. Star Lionel Messi scored all of his country's goals in a hat trick. He has now tied the record for the most career goals at the Men's World Cup. Messi is returning from injury. He wiped away tears as he opened the scoring for Argentina. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. For decades, housing and public health advocates have tried to build a homeless shelter in Sullivan County, but where it will go has been a heated debate for years. Last April, the county legislature came close to approving a location, but failed to agree on the location and the project scope. Then New York State funding for the project closed before legislators had could reach an agreement. Now the state has reopened the housing funding program, but Sullivan County says they're still not ready to apply. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Sullivan County Legislator and Health and Human Services Committee Chair Kat Scott about what's the holdup and what's next for emergency housing in the county.
You know, the county doesn't have an existing homeless shelter, and I would love to just hear a little bit more about what is gateway housing specifically and why do you feel Sullivan County needs one, especially now?
So traditionally or historically, we have utilized our local motels and hotels to house people who are experiencing homelessness and need emergency housing. Of course, during COVID and after COVID, we saw that census go up and we were up in the 300s. And our census hadn't been that high historically. So the idea of having a shelter, right, a gateway housing, a place where we could house people who are experiencing homelessness, where they could get the services that they need, where they could get the dignity that they deserve, and then hopefully transition them to permanent housing, became very important. And this has been an idea that's been in the works through multiple commissioners of the Health and Human Services Department, and it's not something that we've ever been able to get the political will to find a home for. find a place for, or the funding. So the state offers this grant, the HHAP grant, and that seemed to be an answer to one of the big conundrums we had, which was financing. We have, at least during my time as a legislator in 2.5 years, still struggled with finding a location. There's a lot of folks who don't want to have this kind of a facility in their backyard, which is somewhat understandable, but this is a program that's going to have staffing 24 hours a day. There's going to be, security, cameras. There are things that are being put in place to make sure that this facility is a good neighbor, no matter what community it finds a home in. So right now we are hopeful that we may have found a location. I'm a little protective of talking about that because, again, I'm really hoping that this will be the place that we're able to finally serve the community. And so that's where we're at right now.
And as you described, there's been some back and forth as to where this proposed facility would go. Last year, there was this proposed 20-bed facility in Thompson, and that failed to pass a resolution. I've also heard, other potential locations. And then the HHAP program funding closed in September. I'm curious just, how confident are you that the county will be able to submit an application this year?
I don't know how confident I am that we'll be able to submit an application this year, because the previous concepts were new build, right? The 20-bed facility that we had a plan for was previously set for Liberty out by the Department of Social Services. Then we had found a new location out in the town of Thompson, and that was for the same construction plan, right? A 20-bed facility.
Right.
Currently, we're looking at an existing structure that would be retrofit. I don't know at this time how many beds it would be, because we're still kind of in the beginning phases of planning on that potential facility. But I do know that I think the important census to serve is the single census. That traditionally has always been the highest census between family and single. And that is the census that seems to have a higher rate of recidivism, right? Of bouncing in and out of emergency housing on and off the street. So that's where I see the greatest need and also the greatest benefit to the county. Last year, we spent over $5 million housing people in these hotels, motels, and warming shelters, almost $2 million more than the previous calendar year. So in 2024, we spent $3.49 million. And last year, I think we spent just shy of $5.4 million. So trying to serve the community that has the highest need also provides the better fiscal outcome for the taxpayer in Sullivan County.
Can you talk a little bit about just what the process is and how long it would take to submit an application to the state once a location is selected?
So that part actually is easy to talk about. We are partnering with Honor, who is an organization that this is what they do. They go into communities and they help communities who have this kind of a need. So they are very proficient at and efficient at putting these applications together. So once we have determined the site, once we have locked that down, then they can go ahead and do what they need to do. And they are very confident that that would be a quick process for them to put together the application, right? And then once you submit it, then it's up to the state. But I have every confidence in them. But we have to get to a certain point before they can do that.
Right. And this project hasn't come without criticism. There have been some critics that say, you know, the county legislature is dragging its feet in getting a gateway housing open for the community, as you described. There have been millions spent in placing unhoused individuals in hotels and motels. What do you have to say to that criticism?
I say it's valid. It is valid criticism. I think we are talking about a population of people that doesn't have a high amount of empathy. They certainly don't have a lot of political sway. So I say that that is a valid criticism of the legislature, me included. I think that we could do a better job and make this more of a priority. So I, for those critics, I say, absolutely, you're right. And keep calling us out on that. That's the democratic process. I work for the people, and if the people are not happy, they bring their complaints to me and to my colleagues. So when people in our community are advocating for people who are experiencing homelessness, people who are experiencing substance use disorder, people who are experiencing mental health issues, you know, people who other people wish would just go away, yes, that's, we should care about those people too. And I do care about those people. And if it takes people coming to public comment and writing letters to the editor and, you know, reporters such as yourself asking these questions, if that's what it takes to get the job done, then I say keep it up.
And then
those people in our community, they deserve dignity. They deserve, you know, help. They deserve services. So
with the New York State OTDA issuing the RFP, the Homeless Housing and Assistance Program, I think they issued it on June 5th. Could you talk to me a little bit about just what the conversations have looked like within the legislature? Do you feel that there's kind of like a renewed interest or urgency to submit something now that the funding is available?
I think the urgency has remained the same. I think there are people who work within the county who have always understood what the issue was and what the urgency is. And again, there is one particular site that we are leaning towards. So that really hasn't changed anything because, like I said before, we need to get certain things in order before we can get to the next step. And as you know, the history of this project has been, we've got a site, now we don't, so I'm cautiously optimistic. We'll say that. I'm cautiously optimistic that we are moving forward with that. But I'm not sure if our timing is going to work out for this year or next year.
Yeah. Kat, anything else that you want to add that maybe we haven't talked about yet?
I am hopeful. I'm always hopeful. and I am cautiously optimistic that we are on the right path. It is something that I care deeply about because people deserve dignity. They deserve people to care, that they have a roof over their head, that they have what they need to take care of themselves. And there are people in our community who, through no fault of their own, were born with certain chemical imbalances or a product of, dysfunction or trauma. And, they deserve us to advocate for them too. So for me, this is a very important project. It is an important project on a humanitarian level, but it's also an important project on a fiscal level. It is just not sustainable for us to continue to use these hotels and motels. So I'm going to continue to work on this and, I'll keep my fingers crossed. And I just really appreciate the fact that other people out there care deeply about this as well. And I do encourage people to, do not get discouraged. Do not become cynical about this. We just have to keep banging the drum, and we just have to keep showing up. And eventually we will get what our community needs.
Thanks to our reporter, Kimberly Izar, there speaking to Kat Scott, who is a Sullivan County legislator and the Health and Human Services Committee chair. Still to come, a new documentary that's prompting a fresh look at the legacy of the Catskill Game Farm. We'll learn about the shocking story uncovered by its filmmakers. Stay with us. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville and at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we speak to Mon Laferte and Francisca Valenzuela about music, activism, and how they're changing the game for women artists.
I think in Chile, using music as a vehicle to shed light on things has always been there. There is a history of fearless, creative, mega punk.
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
The Las Culturistas Culture Awards have serious fanfare, serious celebrities, but not so serious award categories.
In the category of most triggered, activated, and dysregulated I was this year.
I'm Ilsa Chang. Hosts Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers join us on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For generations of families, the Catskill Game Farm was a beloved destination where visitors could feed animals, get up close to wildlife, and create lasting memories. But a new documentary, American Zoo, explores a lesser known and more troubling chapter of the game farm's history, tracing connections to a German zoologist whose work was linked to breeding experiments during the Nazi era. The film recently premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it raises questions about history, memory, and the legacy of one of the Catskills' most iconic attractions. I spoke with Times Union reporter Sarah Tafton about the beloved zoo's dark past.
The filmmaker, he was on a camping trip in 2022 with his girlfriend, and they wound up exploring the grounds of the game farm. And while they were doing that, they ran into the general manager, and he offered to give them a tour. And during that tour, he found some like 60 millimeter film footage that had just been abandoned inside the gift shop. And he, you know, told the general manager he was interested in it. He was a filmmaker, and the general manager said he could have it. And so then he, by reviewing that footage, you know, he found some kind of a mix of, from what I understand, like a mix of some stuff that was kind of disturbing. And then, you know, it's also just a lot of like nostalgia and, you know, people visiting and enjoying the game farm and footage of people working at the game farm. So from there, it kind of grew as he, you know, reached out to former employees and descendants of the families that operated the game farm. And that's kind of how it took off.
And you mentioned that there were some disturbing things discovered. For people who grew up visiting the game farm, what parts of this story are likely to surprise them the most?
Probably the biggest revelation was that a scientist who was the director at the game farm, he was the son of another scientist who was linked to the Nazi party. And this family had a history of, they were trying to bring back this extinct breed of cattle. And so he kind of continued following in his father's footsteps and trying those experiments while working at the game farm. And by interviewing the daughter of that scientist and reviewing the footage, the filmmaker was kind of able to piece that story together. Some other disturbing footage, there's footage of the families going out and capturing animals from the wild. And I guess some of the animals from the breeding program also wound up with birth defects.
This documentary is examining the work of Heinz Heck Jr., I think is who you're referring to, tracing his work back to those breeding experiments associated with his uncle, Lutz Heck, and the Nazi regime. What evidence does the documentary present about those breeding experiments and their impact on animals at the game farm?
So it was actually, Lutz was his father, which was a little confusing, but so it was his father, and basically he uncovered records at Heinz's daughter's house in Scotland that kind of documented some of the experiments that were going on at the game farm, as well as there was video footage of that as well. And he also interviewed several former gamekeepers, and surprisingly, it wasn't as much of a secret as you'd think it was. Like, people seemed to know about it, but to them, it was kind of like this weird side project that was going on behind the scenes.
And before this documentary, how was the Catskills Game Farm generally remembered in the area? Why did it become such a beloved destination for generations of families?
Yeah, I think it was just something so unique. I mean, it was the first private zoo in the country and one of the largest as well. And so people, you know, not only did locals visit it, but people came up to the city to visit. And it was something you'd bring your kids to, and then they would bring their kids. Like, families just kept coming back for generations. And even the families that worked there, a lot of times it was like intergenerational. So if someone's parent worked there, they might wind up working there. So yeah, it was really just like, you know, remembered very fondly, and people were very sad when it ultimately closed in 2006. So I think this, while this film does show a lot of the love that people had for it, it also kind of exposes some things that people might not have known about.
Do you think it's ultimately arguing that people should view the attraction differently? And do you think it places the game farm perhaps within the broader conversation about zoos and animal welfare and conservation?
Yeah, I definitely think it kind of opens up that dialogue. And also, when I interviewed the filmmaker, you know, he's saying a lot of it, you have to look at it as like what was acceptable at that time. So there wasn't a lot of laws about, you know, going out and capturing animals in the wild, or, you know, laws regulating zoos. So a lot of this, while we look at it now, you know, is very shocking. But at that time, it may not have necessarily been illegal.
The film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. What has the reaction been from audiences who may have fond memories of the attraction or just had seen it for the first time? And have you gotten any reaction after your story was published in the Times Union?
I know Rick Marshall has had some people reach out after the story. I haven't personally had anyone reach out. I know the general manager, who he also grew up going to the game farm as a kid, he went and he got to go to the premiere and watch it. And he thought it was, he thought it was very well done. And in his mind, like, you know, it doesn't change what a special place it was to him when he was a kid, but that he kind of wants to, you know, move forward and have like a new chapter for the game farm.
And is there a plan for that new chapter, since it's been closed since 2006? Are there any plans to open it again, or what's happening at the game farm property?
No, so there's no plans to open it again. Right now there's just the Long Neck Inn that people can go and stay at, where it was the Giraffe House, and previous owners turned it into kind of like a boutique inn. And there's a couple of camping sites, or glamping sites as well. So people can stay there overnight, and they give tours to the guests, but it's not really open so much to just the general public anymore. And you can also rent it out for private events. And right now there are still several pieces of the property that are on the market, but the inn itself is not, but some of the like empty land is up for sale.
And do you know if the documentary, if there are plans to release it widely, more widely than the Tribeca Film Festival?
Yes. Yeah. He was, you know, really hoping that, you know, he'll be able to get it in theaters, especially locally. And he's kind of working out the details of the distribution right now. So nothing's like concrete yet, but it sounds like more people will have the opportunity to see it soon.
That's Sarah Tafton, an investigative reporter and editor for the Times Union. She, along with Rick Marshall, wrote the article about the Catskill Game Farm and the new documentary examining the zoo's dark past. You can read that at timesunion.com. Sarah, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Still to come, the commemorative Juneteenth celebration at Farm Arts Collective. Stay with us. It's Radio Chatskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, inviting you to ring in the summer and support Radio Catskill at the second annual Lou Beach Community House Summer Jamboree. Join us Saturday, 5 to 8, for live music from Lolly and the Pops and Patsy Cline tribute group The Recliners, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets $25 at the door, benefiting Radio Catskill. Info at WJFFradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jamboree, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Friday, communities across the country are marking Juneteenth, the federal holiday that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. In Damascus, Pennsylvania, Farm Arts Collective is celebrating with an evening of theater, music, food, and community conversation. The centerpiece of this year's event is the world premiere of Dawn of a New Century, a new play that imagines a conversation between two of the most influential Black thinkers of the early 20th century. Our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi, has more.
Good morning. Today my guests are Tassa Farrone and Oliver King.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It is so nice to have you here, and you're both back here again at Radio Catskill to talk about Juneteenth and
Absolutely.
This performance that's coming up at Farm Arts. So, Tassa, you are the writer of the play that will be presented.
Dawn of the New Century. It's a conversation between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and about Reconstruction period after the Civil War, when we were trying to figure out as a country what direction we were going to go in. And that's what the play is about. It's still a work in progress. And it came about when I was flying back from the West Coast and Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois sat next to me on the plane.
Lucky you.
Yeah, and they started talking. And I'm writing. Well, they weren't really there, but that's how my inspirations flow. That's how my inspirations flow. I'm thousands of miles in the air, staring out the window into the clouds, and all of a sudden I hear one voice talking over here and another voice talking over here, and I had to grab a pen and some paper and quickly write down what they were saying. And that's how the conversation was written into a play that Oliver kindly asked me, can we do that for Juneteenth? And I said, yeah, sure.
And Oliver, you are the director as well as one of the actors?
Yes. I'm playing the role of Booker T. Washington, actually. So, yes.
And who is the other actor?
My other actor is John Neils.
Oh, yes, we know John Neils.
John and I have worked together quite a few times over the years. He was Lord Capulet in my Shakespeare in the Park. He was phenomenal. And he also played Walter Lee Younger in my production of A Raisin in the Sun. So we know each other very well. We have chemistry.
Oh, good. Well, I remember John Neils from Liberty Three Theater.
Oh, yes, yes. He was working with Paul Austin there for quite a while. I think he's a wonderful actor.
Yeah, he certainly is. And you have Crystal Tweed as part of the event too, correct?
Yes, she's our narrator.
Crystal Tweed is a queen. She's also, the beauty of this whole little production we're doing on Friday is that John and Crystal played Mr. and Mrs. Younger, Walter Lee and Ruth Younger, in my production several years ago. So then they came back together. They've been working together a few times as well, and they're back to work with me on this. And it's like a reunion. It's a really wonderful reunion. So I'm very pleased with this. I wanted to see it as only from a director's point, but one of my actors wasn't available to proceed with us, so I took over the role of Booker T. Washington. But I have to say, I imagined it as a very small, you know, staged reading. But with the creativity of the actors that I have and the crew at Farm Arts, a brilliant lighting technician, and our friend Dana Andrews, who composed a little music. Oh, Dana Andrews is an actor, right?
Yeah.
Dana Jones, I'm sorry. Forgive me, Dana. It's turned into a beautiful, beautiful little one-act play. And I'm very proud to be at the steerhead of this whole thing. So it's going to be quite a nice evening. And also, I'm absolutely thrilled over how Juneteenth has taken off over the past few years. I've been doing Juneteenth presentations for the past maybe 7 or 8 years. And each year, there's more groups around the country, especially in our Hudson Valley area, that are taking on huge celebrations. Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Newburgh, all these communities are now participating with grand festivals and picnics and presentations over Juneteenth. There's also, on the same day, another program in the town of Liberty, at Hanafee Park.
Oh, that's right. I read about that.
Yes, that's being sponsored by the NAACP in Monticello. And that time is from 12 noon to 4 p.m.
So there's time to do both.
Absolutely. We're going to do both, actually. Yeah, a little less of a production at the park, but it's going to be still as educational and enlightening as it is, calling a stage reading of a work in progress.
And when is this event happening?
The Juneteenth, this Friday, well, June 19th, Friday.
7 p.m. at Farm Arts Collective in Damascus.
Ooh, come join us because it's going to be an educational celebration. Good information coming out. Sometimes we know words, we know things, we know names, but hopefully through this experience, we get to share some history. And following the production, we're going to have a Q&A. So you get to ask questions and hopefully we can answer them.
Was what you wrote based on history or more based on your own personal?
A little bit of both, because as a, when I my, that's my writing process. And some people ask me about that. It's happened before where I'm writing something and suddenly a character starts talking to me or speaking, and I write down what they're saying. So this was actually Washington, Booker T. Washington, helping me understand something that I just knew already, but now, oh, he's giving me deeper clarity in it. Same thing with Du Bois, helping me get a clearer understanding of what I learned in history, not in school, because the things that we're going to be talking about are not taught in the classroom, which is kind of unfortunate.
Yes.
And that's what happened with our history, that we're not teaching it as much in the classroom. Now I'm starting to sound like the teacher as opposed to the writer.
Well, that's okay. You can wear two hats.
Okay. I just flipped one cap off and put the other one on. And we have to share our history so we can understand where we're going if we don't know where we came from and where we are.
I feel like I'm still in a learning process as well, because I happen to go to an all-boys Catholic high school.
Which one?
Bishop Lachlan in Brooklyn.
That's right. I remember it was one I was familiar with.
Yes. And I learned nothing about this. So in my continued process of learning, I knew of both characters, both African-American icons, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, but I never knew that they had this conversation. It's based on a real fact, a real historical fact, that they were at odds as to how to proceed after Reconstruction and abolition and the Emancipation Proclamation. It seems Booker T. wanted to keep the agricultural aspect of their experience alive and keep African Americans working on the farm and trying to build a life, a future life on agriculture. And W.B. Du Bois was the intellectual. He wanted us to infiltrate the schools, the colleges, and get an education there. They were at odds as to how to proceed, but then they came to a consensus and they decided to work together. And I think that's something that should be taught in the high schools, but I never learned it. So I feel like I'm still learning. And it's nice to have friends like Tasa here to bring me up to date on those things as well. So.
Well, to bring all of us up to date. Absolutely. And to offer this to the community. Absolutely. Through Farm Arts.
Yes.
Because we all are in the process of learning.
Exactly.
Uncovering hidden facts.
Hidden truths. And
well, thank you again.
Thank you. And one other thing, we'll get to talk about the origin of Juneteenth. Where did it come from and how did it spread from Texas across the whole country?
We look forward to it all.
Okay. And thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Mansi as well. Coming up, Aaron Hicklin joins us for a preview of the Deepwater Literary Festival. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on This American Life. If you're stuck in an ICE detention facility right now with no reliable way to communicate with the outside world, no money, how do you tell your loved ones where you are? We can yell over the massive walls to the people outside. Or, and not many people can do this, you can throw a bottle with a note. That's this week.
This American Life,
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radio Lab.
I feel like I have Stockholm Syndrome or something.
Stockholm Syndrome.
A strange condition born out of a bank robbery in Stockholm.
The hostages start doing unexpected things.
Mysterious. How do these victims get changed?
And how did it change the rest of us?
Allowed me to take a deep breath.
For the better and...
40 years of the feeling of doing something wrong.
For the worse. That's on the next Radio Lab. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg this weekend with a program that brings together some of the country's most acclaimed writers, artists, and storytellers. This year's theme is Time Shift, exploring how memory, history, and the future shape the stories we tell. This year's festival features conversations with authors including Joyce Carol Oates, Marlon James, Francine Prose, and George Packer, along with a keynote presentation from that guy that created Radiolab, the promo you just heard, Jad Abumrad, and who we talked to on Monday. Founded in 2019, Deepwater has quickly become one of the region's premier literary events, drawing audiences from across the country while maintaining its strong ties to the Upper Delaware River Valley. Joining us now, Aaron Hicklin, founder and director of the Deepwater Literary Festival and host of Shelf Life, Sundays at noon here on Radio Catskill. Aaron, welcome back.
Hey, Tim. Thank you for having me on.
And wanted to just fill in folks who may not know exactly what Deepwater is. How did it come about? What is it all about?
So, I have always been drawn to happenings. Many of us who live up here, I think, rely on them for community, a sense of place, who we are, and connection. In a weird way, although I opened a bookstore in Narrowsburg in 2015, the festival sort of came first. It came first as an idea. The bookstore was almost a conduit to launching the festival. I wanted to create a reason for bringing people together to talk about ideas, have conversations about books, and engage with what I think of still as one of our most vibrant artistic forms, the book, the novel. But also, storytelling is our oldest tradition. I'd love to go back in time and be a fly on the wall at that point when the first story was told. And I think, in a sense, we're all kind of, the inheritors of that tradition. And I like to think that Deepwater plays its own role. So, a festival in a place like Narrowsburg is hard to pull off, but it's also incredibly rewarding. I would say much more rewarding than in a city where you're sort of spoiled for choice. There's endless number of literary events, book events, theatrical events, presentations that you could do on any given night. A lot of that is sort of, it's harder to get those conversations up here. And I think the festival has evolved as a kind of ecosystem for bringing writers, local and national and even international, together in one place on the banks of the mighty Delaware once a year for a just for a big confab with the people that live here and those that travel here for it.
And every festival has a theme. This year's theme, Time Shift. Why this year's theme? What brought that about?
Well, first of all, I'm at an age, where time shift begins to feel like less a theme than a diagnosis. I mean, I do wonder where my life has run away to. I think a lot of us in 2018, 2019 really felt that the world was speeding up. Some of that was to do with technology. I mean, a lot of it was to do with technology, but I was just sort of very aware that everything was happening really fast. Change was happening fast. Political change happens fast. People didn't have patience anymore. And then we were hit with COVID, which did the very opposite, right? It slowed time down. In a way, a lot of people thought of it as a kind of massive reset. It was painful and traumatic, but it also changed how we approach time. And now I feel we've kind of gone back to that sort of 2018, 2019 period. In some ways, it's even worse. It's even faster than it felt then. So a lot of it was about that, a kind of sense that we were in this very strange period where time seemed first fast, then very slow, and now really fast again. And thinking, you know, how does literature respond to that? How does the book, the novel, you know, the nonfiction exploration respond to that? And, you know, novels have always done that. I mean, you mentioned Jad Abumrad, the founder of Radiolab, who will be presenting this kind of keynote that launches the festival. And he found something very interesting, which is, you know, a recording of Virginia Woolf, where she talks about this, about how art responds to times of change and crisis, the sense of things speeding up. And I think that's really the fundamental question we want to ask this year. And, you know, it's something that books have always tackled. I think it emerges in a sense in all sorts of genres that deal with time sort of misbehaving, the way the past often refuses to stay in the past or the future seems to arrive early. Like, that's at the heart of a lot of books. Historical fiction, speculative fiction really plays with those ideas. But also the form of how we write is often about time. You know, the way a short story, for example, can really compress time or really slow it down. So it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of an exploration of really what does time mean and how does it present in storytelling?
When I spoke with Jad on Monday, and we were talking about him revisiting Virginia Woolf's work, and we were talking about the technological upheavals that were occurring at that time, radio and cinema, the railroad, even like the telegraph, things that were happening in the world, and they were speeding up time for people. And that just must have been such a crazy thing for people to get their head around. And now you fast forward to now, when that's happening again at an even more rapid pace with all the technology and AI.
Yes. And in fact, we have a panel that I think will talk very specifically to that, which is, about Elon Musk. I mean, he's the name in the room you can't really escape from, for better or worse. And they've written a book really sort of looking at the way that these technocrats, these people who really are running the world, I mean, they're more powerful, they have more money than sort of GDP of most countries. How they're dictating our future, how they're sort of building the future. So that conversation is happening on Saturday. It's based on a book called Muskism. And it's really sort of about this sort of tech fantasy, really, that the elites have, that innovation can be used in such a way that they can evade kind of accountability and reorganizing society in their own image. And I think we're all, in some ways, victims of that right now, or at least we're trying to deal with that because it affects all of us. And I think that's a very live question that will be at the heart of that conversation, but also running throughout the festival.
Let's talk about some of the other highlights of the festival to let folks know. It's, you know, happening Friday with that keynote from Jad Abumrad, and then some other highlights that we should tell folks about.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things I'm excited about. I mean, we have Joyce Carol Oates, who's attended the festival once before. She's back. She's in conversation with A.M. Holmes. That's a major Sunday conversation on the short story and the way it kind of bends time and compresses a life. Joyce turned 88 yesterday. Her new book of short stories, Frenzy, came out yesterday. She's written over 100 books. I mean, she's an absolute phenomenon. She's also something of a provocateur. She spends a lot of time on X, formerly known as Twitter, baiting people like Elon Musk. And I just love that spirit, that impish spirit of a worldly figure like Joyce Carol Oates, who's able to kind of stand up to bullying. So there'll be a lot of questions, I think, from the audience for her. That's on Sunday. It is at capacity, but we have a wait list. Last year, a few events hit capacity, and we were able to get quite a few people in just based on, you know, those who can't make it at the last minute. We always reserve some comps for writers and other people. If they don't turn up, we release those at the time of the event. So she's on at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. And then George Packer, who's a Pulitzer-winning writer, he's on stage on Saturday with Ben Fountain and Amal El-Motar. These are really interesting writers. They're all using kind of slightly futuristic dystopias to explore in some ways what America is today. So it's really about the way that writers can take on collapse and political delirium, I suppose, and show how, you know, those things are sort of hiding inside the present, but by setting those novels slightly in the future. And then Raphael Shirley is a local artist. She does incredible installation work. She did something last year. We called it 200 Pink Smoke Flares Twice. And these were sort of smoke flares that were lit up on the Fireman's Field in Narrowsburg close to dusk on Saturday night. And her whole practice is about, I guess, sort of brevity and transition. So it was really about how that smoke drifted and fell across the river valley. She's doing something similar this year, but it's indoors. It will be at the Union in that huge old school gymnasium now known as Delaware Hall. It's a free event and it involves smoke, parabolic mirrors. Don't ask me what a parabolic mirror is. and music, as well as kind of other sort of, I think, lighting and sound. Very short, though. It's about a 20-minute experience. We've got that running or rotating twice at 7 p.m. on Saturday and 8:30 p.m. And you can walk out of that 8:30 p.m. showing straight into the festival party, which takes place next to the Union under a tent. So I'm really excited about that. Raphael is incredible, and this is definitely a heavy lift. It's been months in the making. And we're just very lucky to have a venue the scale of that old school gymnasium to accommodate it. And we have Marlon James, who has been at every single one of Deepwater Literary Festivals since 2018. He's a Booker Prize winning author. His new book comes out in September. We always find a slot for him because he's entertaining, funny, and also just incredibly thoughtful. You can set him in a room and ask him to talk about anything, and he will produce the most masterful thesis. This year, he's talking with Fab Five Freddy, who is kind of a progenitor, really, of kind of graffiti art and street art in New York from the 1980s through to the present. He's kind of, I think he's famously name-checked in a Blondie song, Fab Five Freddy.
I believe so.
Said it. Yeah, so he's here. Randomly, he's here. So we're really talking about how New York in the 80s, you know, late 70s, 80s, at a time when it was, you know, considered sort of financially broken, was creatively very, very rich. So that kind of birthplace, really, of the sort of street art and hip-hop that Fab Five Freddy was right at the center of. He's written a memoir. So we'll get to hear him in conversation with Marlon about that on Saturday. I mean, that's four items right there. Jad, you already mentioned, which sort of sets up the whole event. We have a lot of installation this year, a lot of sort of street art, which I'm really excited about. I say street art, it's actually happening inside shops along Main Street. Things, for example, like a piece that Amy Yost, who's a local artist, has created. It's a sort of a piece of animation that will run in the 108, which is that big black barn, converted barn at the end of Main Street. And a piece called This Story is a Bag, which actually our own assistant producer, Liz Lepro, has put together. It's inspired by an Ursula Le Guin essay that sort of challenges the sort of mythical idea of the short story as being sort of centered on, you know, ancient warriors running out to sort of kill, kill wildlife, and really sort of makes it about the gatherers rather than the hunters, the people that have to find a bag to collect the oats or the grains, and that bag becomes a container, and that container becomes the beginning of storytelling. It's a wonderful essay, really delightful. And we managed to get Tilda Swinton, the actor, to record that for us. So it involves a recording, a film, and an installation at Maison Bergone, which is on Bridge Street. It's the old antique store there. Surprisingly spacious, capacious in there. We'll have cocktails open to everyone for a special opening on Friday, 2 days from now, 6:30 p.m., and that will lead into Jad's keynote at 7:30 at the Tustin. So that's just prior to that. And there's a lot more of that. You can find it all on the program, deepwaterfestival.com. But most of that is free. The only things we're charging for are the panels at the Tustin Theater, which are all $15 each, the festival party. And then we have a literary brunch on Sunday at La Cigone. And that is, you know, that is a heftier price tag of $35, which covers a full brunch, but also an amazing opportunity to see Luke Barr in conversation on a book he's written, which is the sort of secret history of French cuisine. He's going to take us into the sort of stories, the backfighting, and the personalities and peccadilloes of some of the greatest chefs in, I guess, the land that we all think of as the sort of, you know, crux of gourmet food, France. So that happens on Sunday. Other than that, everything else is free and happening throughout the weekend. I think the last thing that we're closing out with is the Yarn Slingers, which is Narrowsburg's, or this region's own storytelling collective. And they will read stories inspired by our theme of time. Their sub-theme is killing time. So expect maybe a little bit of gore in some of those stories. Those will be held in the Lutheran Church, St. Paul's Lutheran Church on Erie Avenue in Narrowsburg, starting at, I think that's 4:00. But if I get it wrong, don't kill me. It might be 5.
Check deepwaterfestival.com for all of the jam-packed program there. And just quickly before we go, I mean, this really goes beyond the standard model of a writer's festival and invites the audience, you know, to experience things beyond the page. And how does the town become a part of that?
You know, well, in part because this is a small town, so it can't help but be part of it. We sort of take over all the venues, and that means taking over a lot of the vendors, the storefronts on Main Street. We have a lot of partners here, incredible partners. So, you know, the Delaware Valley Arts Organization is our primary partner. We work with them with Krause Hall and the Tustin Theater, the Union. Obviously, this year we're doing quite a few things there. The shops in Narrowsburg, that will be taken over by an independent book fair on the ground floor. Lots of regional publishers. So all of those things sort of go towards making it something very, I think, collaborative and collective. NACL, the North American Cultural Laboratory, is presenting the residents of its recent queer playwrights residency. That happens on Saturday at 5:00. And Farm Arts is presenting a piece from its upcoming summer work that happens to sort of work with our theme on a piece inspired by Euripides' Trojan Women. So, you know, we're really collaborating with a lot of regional arts organizations, but also with all the spaces here. So I think that kind of gives you this magic, which, I don't think you would ever get in a city where you can just own the town.
Yeah. That is Aaron Hicklin, founder and director of the Deepwater Literary Festival. It's this weekend in the town of Narrowsburg. Radio Catskill proud to be a media partner, and we'll have more coverage of that throughout the rest of the week. But Aaron, before we go, you know the name of that song that Fab Five Freddy was name checked in by Blondie? That is Rapture.
Of course.
I think we have to go out on that. Thank you. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Ben Rhodes, former speechwriter and deputy national security advisor to President Obama. His new book is All We Say, The Battle for American Identity. It's a collection of landmark speeches in American history and a look at how they reflected and shaped America's purpose and values. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, we'll get some shifting clouds and sun this afternoon and a thunderstorm possible as well with some gusty winds that might accompany the downpour. High 73, overcast and a brief shower or two later on tonight, a low 59, and watch out for more thunderstorms, heavy ones, tomorrow.